Okay, welcome everyone to this brief overview about E1, TDM, PDH, and SDH basics. We will learn very soon what those acronyms mean. So what is this all about? It's about retro networking, a topic that I like particularly personally, old communications technology. Basically, the worldwide technology for wide area networking, you could say, before before Ethernet was considered a technology that you use outside of the LAN, of the local area network, as a wide area network, and is the transport layer for all kinds of digital communications of the mainly 1980s and 1990s. Originally developed for digital circuit switch telephony. So the acronyms that we will be covering here, it's not too many of them compared to the normal telecom talks that you may know from Osmo DevCall. So we have TDM, the time division multiplex, which exists also in GSM and in LTE. But here we are talking about a circuit switched copper or fiber-based time division multiplex, which means that we have multiple streams of information that get multiplexed into one particular medium by chopping it in chunks of time and assigning time slots to it, and then thereby facilitating multiple streams in a single medium. There is PDH, the Plesio-Kronos digital hierarchy. We will get to what that exactly means, which is the first and older TDM technology covering a number of different data rates. The E1 or T1 or J1 in Japan are the most commonly known variants of this family of systems. And last but not least, there is SDH, the synchronous digital hierarchy, which is also TDM multiplex at various rates with some differences, which we will cover. And if you ever heard of an STM1 link or for the Americans, an OC3 link, then this is a part of the SDH system of transmission. So looking at PDH first, what is this about? This is very important to note that we're talking about point-to-point interfaces between two ends. We're not talking about some kind of network technology like Ethernet or Wi-Fi, where you have multicast and broadcasts and multiple participants. It's point-to-point interfaces between two specific locations. We have a transparent bit stream with specified bit clock. Bit stream meaning that fundamentally there is no you don't know where, well, you need an additional layer on top of it in order to delimit bytes and packets inside this bit stream. So it's really unaligned bit stream. Often this bit stream is divided into a number of 64 kilobit time slots. I'm saying often because it's not always the case. That's one of the strange parts of this technology. But in most incarnations, you will find one of these time slots being used for framing. That's time slot zero, which is really just to detect the starter frame signaling and signaling of CRC failures and so on. And it's not usable for user plane data or signaling. And then also one other time slot is often used for the telephony related signaling in these technologies. So why 64 kilobit time slots in all of this? Well, it was all developed for telephony, for digital transport of telephony. And we need a data rate that is sufficient for a classic voice call. In the 1960s already, PCM, pulse code modulation for digital telephony, was developed, and they set out and standardized, or de facto standardized, that a sample rate of 8 kilohertz shall be used with 8-bit samples, and that leads to a 64 kilobit bit stream rate for a single subscriber, a single telephone call. These 8-bit samples are not linear, but somehow weighted, the quantization. So there's curves which indicate how significant each of those bits is. There's two of them. There's ULaw and ALaw, also called PCMU and PCMA, used in different regions around the world. Internationally, ALaw is basically the standard. Also, in international calls in general, ALaw is used, and ULaw is really just North America and Japan. These user plane formats, how voice samples, digital voice samples are encoded in such 64 kilobits, is, and in these curves are specified in ITU-T spec G711. Now, if we combine multiple of those time slots together, we get to these multiplexes, to those rates within a hierarchy. They are called so-called E-carriers from E1 to E5. In practice, really only E1 and E3 are relevant. I mean, you can find in literature that E4 and E5 was used in some backbone between telephony switches, but it's if you haven't worked for a carrier, I don't think anyone will have seen those interfaces, whereas E1 and E3 have been and still are, and we will get to that, still actively in use. So we see here the bit rates. So an E1 line has 2048 kilobits, or 2.048 megabits. There are some alternative names here, particularly in Germany. I'm not sure how much they've also been used internationally. These have been used heavily inside the postal companies and telecommunication companies. So this is a PCM30 line. PCM30 means we have 30 user channels, telephony channels, in PCM encoded inside one multiplex. If you multiply 64 by 30, you will end up with 1920 or something like that, and not 2048. It's because there's two additional time slots, as I mentioned, one for the TS0 for the frame alignment, and usually TS16 for the telephony signaling. So we have two more time slots. So we have 32 64 kilobit slots, but only 30 of these are used for voice calls. And in this PCM naming scheme, only the actual user channels are called. All of this has been developed already in the 60s. So it's relatively old technology, but being developed in the 60s, of course, doesn't mean it has seen widespread use. I think the 80s were the phase where most of the telephony systems were built and digitized around the world. But of course, this depends on the region, on the country. So we know the H in PDH is for hierarchy. And this is actually a graph from the official specs showing this kind of hierarchical nature. So we start from a 64 kilobit time slot here. We see 1 to 31, so we combine multiple of those, and we end up with a 2048 kilobit multiplex, which is then an E1 interface here. Now you see the mouse pointer, an E1 interface here, the one at the end. And if we combine 1 to 4, so 4 of these E1 interfaces, we end up in an E2 multiplex, which has, of course, 4 times the bit rate. And if we again combine 4 of those, we end up, and so on, with a 34 megabit, which is an E3 interface. We combine even more of those, and it goes on basically to multiplex that way in this digital hierarchy. And that's why it's called a hierarchy, because you have ever larger bit rates that get multiplexed together in order to be carried along some common medium. So where was it used? Really globally, everywhere. It was the backbone of worldwide telephony networks. The smallest part being the E1 or T1, T1 being the American system, which we won't cover in detail here. System also sometimes named as PRI or PRI, as a primary rate ISDN lines. If you use such a E1 multiplex with an ISDN protocol stack on top, this was very commonly used to connect PBXs of companies to the public telephony network, and you had these 30 voice channels and one signaling channel for the telephony signaling using the Q931 protocol. And the higher order multiplexes you would see between digital telephone exchanges in the telephony system. So we had these 30B channels. They were, of course, not just used for voice calls, but also for fax or digital samples of analog modem calls or transparent digital streams for X75 or V110. That's basically the ISDN dial-up that was used then for internet access or something like that. And the D channels specifically on depending on the interface. On the user interface, meaning that you as a normal subscriber or as a, let's say, commercial subscriber company attaching to the telephone network, you would get one of these primary rate interfaces where the D-channel protocol stack is LAPD on layer 2. That's also basically where LAPDM, the mobile version for GSM on the radio interface, has as a close relative to this one. And as a layer 3 protocol, there was Q931 or sometimes called DSS1 as a protocol for telephone signaling. The same like physical E1 circuit, just with a different D-channel protocol, was also used on other interfaces, for example, between telephone exchanges. So the B-channels, the voice channels, are exactly the same. But the signaling channel is structured differently. So instead of the ISDN user interface protocols, here we have the signaling system 7, which consists of MTP2, MTP3, and then on the higher level, it was ISUP, the ISDN user part, or TUP, the telephony user part, for signaling telephone calls between telephone exchanges or between telephone operators, using the same E1 or multiple E1 circuits, basically. In cellular networks, as many in the Osmocom community know, also, a lot of PDH technology is used. Basically, everything in GSM that's not the UM radio interface was specified over ISDN or over PDH technology, to be more specific. So on the AVIS, on the A interface, on other interfaces in the core network, virtually every interface in the entire network was specified this way. The ABIS interface is a bit different than, let's say, an ISDN user interface, because there, the B channels, we don't only, well, we still have 30 of those B channels, but inside each of the B channels, we don't have a single 64 kilobit voice call with this PCMA, PCMU encoding, but we actually split it up in four 16 kilobit subslots. So we can have four GSM voice codec calls within one B channel, meaning if we think of 30 B channels, we can have 120 concurrent voice calls on one of those E1 lines. Plus, on the D channel, we only have the Q921 LAPD protocol as the same as in ISDN for certain, like landline telephony use. But the higher layer protocols are then ABIS, RSL, and OML on top of this LAPD protocol. On the A interface, it's again a different protocol stack. B channels are here than normal B channels, like in the circuit switched landline telephony network. So the transcoding has already happened next to the BSC. So between BSC and MSC, we already have 64 kilobit normal A-law, U-law audio. And on the D channel, we have MTP2, MTP3, like in the SS7 between telephone exchanges. But then we have new higher layer protocols, which is connection oriented SCCP, and then the BSSAP, BSS map DTAP stack for the GSM signaling. For GPRS, for example, we have the GB interface, which has yet another configuration of such an E1 line. Here we have also a framed E1 line as basis, but we concatenate all the 30B channels together, so they form one bit stream over all these 30B channels. And inside these 30B channels, we run one HDLC instance to delineate the start and stop of messages or packets inside this bit stream. And inside that, we have frame relay as a separate packet switched technology. And inside the frame relay, then we have the GPRS specific NS and BSS GP protocols. In UMTS, also, we have heavy use of PDH interfaces. On the IOB interface between node B and RNC, it's used. It's used also on the interface between RNC and MSC and or SGSN. So basically the same like ABIS or A interface on that level, it's used. And again, in the core network, it's used just like in GSM. The added complexity layer, since UMTS was universal and ATM was quite hip in the late 90s as the coming technology that was coming but then disappeared very quickly, is ATM. So in the IUB interface between a base station, a node B, and the RNC, actually it's not just an E1 line with ISDN specific protocols like in the GSM case, but they added an additional layer of ATM in there, particularly with a nasty inverse ATM multiplex, which means you take four E1 lines and then sort of have something like link aggregation in Ethernet, and then you run ATM over that to talk to your base station. PDH was also used for broadband internet access with frame relay, where again you have a physical E1 line, but not ISDN and telephone calls, but frame relay inside, very much like the GB interface, with the difference being that you have directly IP packets inside frame relay and not this GPRS-specific intermediate protocol stack. Furthermore, also inbound internet dial-up as an ISP. So if you are an ISP in the 90s, you would get many of those E1 lines or even higher order multiplexes. And then you wouldn't connect a PBX to it, but you would connect modem banks to terminate these E1 lines, each of them with 30 inbound subscribers dialing into your internet service provider. So that's yet another use case where PDH technology was used. Now, after all this history, where is TDM still being used today? In 2021, most of the carriers of public national, regional, international networks, of course, long have migrated to Ethernet, most likely with MPLS on top of that. TDM, PDH technology is not widely used anymore. The public ISDN networks are mostly being dismantled or have already been dismantled. However, there's still a significant user base, particularly in poorer countries. If you think beyond Europe and the US, you will still find a lot of countries where these technologies are in heavy use. And still, even in modern industrialized countries, you have a number of private telecommunication networks, such as those of railway operators or corporate telephony networks, where PDH is still in use, or even SDH, which we will get to in a second. Also, in cellular operators, PDH is not fully removed yet. So even in Germany, you will still find base stations that have an ABIS interface over E1. Maybe that E1 line is only, 1, 2, 3, 4 meters long, and then you have some equipment that performs a transport of encapsulation of this E1 over Ethernet or over MPLS or L2TP or some other technology, basically a TDM over packet a gateway, but you still have some meters of E1 lines in GSM networks in Western countries. Likewise, on the other interfaces, I think IUB is unlikely to be found anymore since 3G networks are switched off in European countries, but you see those still occasionally. Now, SDH is the more modern technology of the TDM principle. It was developed in the 1980s, so not the 60s, but the 80s. And the main difference between those two is, as the name already implies, in PDH we have this plesiochronos technology, and in SDH we have synchronous. Now, what does that mean? Plesio means almost in Greek, so it's basically almost synchronous, the clock between the devices in a network. However, the clocks, it was not feasible at that time when these technologies were developed to synchronize the clock over a countrywide or even an international network. And thereby, the clocks were allowed to drift to each other by up to 50 ppm. And that means, of course, that somehow, if, let's say, you're sending with a certain clock rate data and you have a multiplexer that multiplexes into a higher order interface and the clock has a slightly different clock rate, you have drift. And that means you need to use bit stuffing to basically fill the gaps between those different clock rates, or drop bits in the inverse direction if the clock rates are different. And in SDH, the network is really synchronous, so you can run the entire network with the identical clock that's synchronized, and you don't have bit slips, cycle slips, and you don't need bit stuffing anymore, and things get much easier. It also leads to much less complex and therefore less expensive multiplex equipment, because in PDH, any device that demultiplexes and remultiplexes the streams would have to do the bit stuffing to get down to the unstuffing to get down to the 64K slots and before remultiplexing them. And in SDH, you can, since everything is synchronous, you can very easily take one lower bitrate time slot out of a higher bitrate stream and add and drop such streams from larger multiplexes. And as a result, ever since SDH became more widespread in the late 80s, particularly in the 90s, PDH was only used for E1 or E3 on the access level to connect to a network, but then the carriers would actually use SDH on their end. Now, SDH rates, according to the spec, are these. There are some others that sometimes are used, but you can actually see this is from 51 megabit up to already 39 gigabit of data rates. The most commonly ones that people would recognize is STM1 with 155 megabits and STM4 with 602 megabits. Here's the specification numbers for those who want to look at it. And one of the interesting bits is that SDH can not only carry SDH signals, but there's basically a compatibility layer how PDH signals can be multiplexed into SDH. So you can run an STM1 line, which is this 155 megabit stream, and you can basically multiplex 63 E1 lines into such an STM1 circuit. And there are multiplexers devices that do this. I have luckily I now have a couple of these in my basement to play with. So you really have 63 RJ45 sockets with E1 lines and one SFP transceiver for the STM1, and it just converts and multiplexes those two interfaces. Yeah, and that was the quick tour de force on the basics of TDM, SDH, PDH. At this point, we can ask for some questions. If anyone has one, questions on the record at this point.
Why did it? I mean, if they went to the trouble of going synchronous with SDH, why didn't they go synchronous with the E1 lines that they're multiplexing in there?
Because the E1 lines might still have different clocks. So you have an SDH network that's synchronous, but you interface with PDH networks that have 50 ppm drift or can have 50 ppm drift.
Okay, right. Yeah, but I mean, okay, yeah.
If you create a new network from scratch, then of course you could make sure that all of the E1 lines that you connect to your SDH are synchronous. And I think there is even a spec for doing synchronous E1 in SDH.
But what they call synchronous is not even what I call synchronous, because there is still bit stuffing in there. Like, it's just. Yeah, there was no simple case when last time I looked at the spec, and I was wondering, like, because, you know, if those E1 lines go to a BTS or something like that, like, the BTS is going to basically slave itself to the E1. So if the multiplexer becomes the clock master, the E1 is going to be perfectly synchronous, and you can avoid all the crap they put in the in there to encapsulate E1 in STM and have a nice, you know, precisely.
Yeah, I think the point is, you don't have to be 50 ppm off. You can, of course, run your E1 network with a strict clock hierarchy, but there, in the old times, there just wasn't a requirement that you have this strict hierarchy. So you could have some islands that are just drifting. They are a little bit fast in the morning and slow in the evening. And there you have all these drop bits and insert bits slots in your frames, basically, for this case. But you don't have to. I mean, if everything is synchronous, it just never happens.
But I wish they included like a true synchronous mode in the spec, like an easy mode.
Yeah, so something like an STM 0.25 or something like that. where then, I get your point. Yeah, but I mean, in general, I mean, it was basically that you had these existing PDH networks, and at some, like at the remote end of those PDH networks, you have a BTS or some user connected to it in some way. And only in the core, you would start to introduce SDH, and then you have all these problems that I mentioned originally. And that was sort of, I think, the reason why they didn't do it anyway, any other way.
Hi. I'm kind of always interested a little bit in the physical mediums that these things were running over. I mean, when you talk about, you know, this E1 multiplexed into an E3, then for, you know, exchange to exchange communication, what kind of physical mediums was this copper wires? How far could they be, or what kind of amplification equipment was in between, or how did all that work? Do you know?
Yeah, so for E1, it was very common to do it over twisted copper wires, the telephony wires. There is, I think it's even the first SDSL standard is with 2048 bits, exactly for that reason, so that you could transmit over a single copper pair an E1 line. There's also physical standards for doing E1 over multiple copper pairs, older ones, and for longer distance. I don't know. I cannot quote the distances for those, but it's basically DSL, early DSL type technology. For E3, it was not possible to do it over a twisted pair, but over coaxial wire. And this related also to the fact that even before digital trunk lines between telephone exchanges were put in place, there was already analog multiplex, so so-called carrier frequency, so analog modulation, basically. So you have lots of different carrier frequencies, and you have analog frequency modulation to different carrier frequencies over coaxial wire. So they had coaxial wire between telephone exchanges, and E3 could then be used over such coaxial cables. For the higher order ones, I don't know, to be honest. I would expect the same. You could do at least some of those still over the coaxial wires until you ran into whatever the bandwidth of those coaxial wires was, the limits. A lot of it was also done over microwave, where you have microwave technology to modulate PDH signals onto microwave links between towers. And for all of them, actually, starting even from E1, there also existed versions where you talk them over fiber optics. In the later days, it could have been that, meaning late 90s or so, if you ordered an E1 line, it could have been that the telephone company actually puts a fiber optic cable to you, and then you just use it to carry E1 over that, which, of course, is a gross waste of the capacity of the fiber, but was just done that way. And also for E3 and so on. For the SDH technology, I think all of it has always been specified over fiber optic from the beginning. So that was all optical communication. So that's as much as I can say. Of course, I'm not an expert. I haven't been working for a telephone operator, not now and not during these days, but that's my information. Then I quickly stop the recording. Thanks again.